Maboff!
This is the final Scammapalooza for 2015. The show will be back in January with more interviews with swindlers, magicians, deceivers, and their victims. For more information on today's show, check out conman.com.au. And if you do enjoy the show, why not head to iTunes and leave a review? It's almost Christmas, and you don't want Santa to find out. He's a vindictive jerk, that guy. I've had the pleasure to talk about hoaxes, magic, con artists and historical frauds this year. And for the final show, we're combining all of those topics to talk about Harry Houdini and Mina Crandon. What happened when the most famous magician and hoax buster in history went toe-to-toe with one of the world's most notorious psychics? He was a legendary master of illusion with an obsession with death, while she was a self-proclaimed spirit medium with a penchant for hypersexual seances and theatrical paranormal activity. On this week's episode, John Cox from the website Wild About Harry tells the tale of Houdini, Mina, and the struggle between spiritualism and science. My name is Nicholas J. Johnson, and this is Scammapalooza. Your website, Wild About Harry, is a thing of beauty. There is an extraordinary level of detail that you've put into covering his life and people around him's lives as well, and the time that he was living. Where did this all begin? Where did your love of Houdini come from?
Well, my love of Houdini started when I was 10 years old. In fact, it would be 40 years last week, when I saw the Tony Curtis Houdini movie made in 1953. I don't know if you've ever seen it.
I have.
Great old classic Hollywood movie. And I saw that when I was 10, and I just thought, this is fascinating. I want to find out more about this man. And so I went and got a book and just continued to study him all the way today. And, you know, literally every day it seems like I, or at least every month I learn something new or see a new photo or something about him. So it never stops.
Speaking of photographs, there is a photo on your website of you age 14, or I don't know, you look very young, sitting on your, in your room, just surrounded by Harry Houdini paraphernalia. And that's where, and it's local. I can't remember the exact headline, but it's like local teen is wild about Harry.
I think it is teen is wild about Harry. When I was a few years kind of into my Houdini obsession, I sort of took a page from Houdini's book and started promoting myself. And I wrote to a local newspaper and they did a little story on me, and then a larger paper did. And I was even in the Los Angeles Times, and I wound up on TV doing a straitjacket escape. And I kind of had this little brush with fame when I was a teenage escape artist.
Do you still perform? Are you still a performing magician?
No. I don't perform any magic. I found out early on that really wasn't for me. I'm a little too shy to perform magic. But I do lecture on Houdini, so I perform in that way.
To be honest, I think it's great that there are people in the world who are fascinated about magic and the world of magic without necessarily being performing magicians. Because there's a lot of guys, and you see them, and they have this love of magic, and I think they reach a point where perhaps they're too shy or they're not really into the actual performing, but they feel like they're kind of obliged to get up on stage because they're like, well, I do like magic, so I guess I better put on a show.
Well, it's nice because I'm a magician member of the Magic Castle, but they allow people that are just historians to be magician members. So they recognize that there are some people who can contribute to the art of magic just that, as historians, and that's kind of nice.
And you've definitely contributed to the art of magic with this, with the website. There's so much information there. You seem to, not only do you obviously just talk about Houdini's life, you've got all the current Houdini events that are coming up, because there's always Houdini events and centenaries of various things happening, particularly around now. But also then you review all of the Houdini movies and miniseries and TV shows, and for accuracy, including the most recent one with Adrian Brody that you gave, in terms of accuracy, you gave it a thumbs down. You said it was the least, did it end up being the least accurate Harry Houdini movie?
You know, it's a yes and no. Certainly the first half. I mean, none of them are very accurate. They just can't be. You know, I understand. And I'm not really a huge stickler for movies, you know, following the letter of his life. I know that they have to time compress and they have to create entertainment. Even the old Tony Curtis movie, which I love, there's really kind of not a moment in it that's true, but the superstructure of his life is sort of true. The Adrian Brody movie kind of just goes off and creates a whole cloth fiction about him being a spy which is really something that was generated this century in a biography, an idea which I don't really buy. So the fact that it to make that work, it had to mess with the timeline of his life. So it really, the first half of it is really quite inaccurate in a way that seems a little bit of a more of a violation than the Curtis movie, which is doing it for entertainment. This is just doing it to make him a super spy, because you'll find that interesting. But then the second half, and it was in the US here, it was aired over two nights. The second half is pretty accurate, and it's actually the first biopic to really portray the events of his death accurately. So it gets points for that. So it's both accurate and inaccurate, but the spy stuff, I think, was a bridge too far. That was very close to just Houdini fiction, of which there's a lot of Houdini fiction too, Houdini versus vampires. Mm-hmm. This one got very close to just being Houdini fiction.
One of my favorites is the Disney one with, I think it's Will Wheaton, I think, playing a young Houdini.
Yeah, it's young Harry Houdini. We just seen that, actually. I have a copy of it that I recorded in 1987, I think it aired. And we screened it at the Magic Castle with Will Wheaton, who hadn't seen it since 1987. And it was a blast, and he really loved it. He had so many neat memories of making that. It's good fun.
It is great fun. It's great fun. But we should talk about the real Houdini's life and not the various fictional supernatural spy superhero. I mean, a lot of people do call him the world's first superhero.
That was the subtitle of the biography, the 2006 biography, The Making of America's First Superhero. So that was the book, by the way, that claimed that he may have been a spy. Lately, it has kind of been tying him into the superhero mythology, which he was always a part of that. Even in his own life, there were adventures of, you know, the marvelous ventures of Houdini. He created some of his own fictions.
Where did he grow up? What sort of sparked his love of magic at an early age?
He's actually born in Budapest, Hungary. And he immigrated to America when he was 4 years old, grew up in small town of Appleton, Wisconsin, and then later Milwaukee. He probably became interested in magic when he was living in Milwaukee, and he saw the performance of a magician named Dr. Lin, who was an English performer who was touring around the United States at that time. It was said his father brought him to a performance. And one of the things that Dr. Lin did was an illusion called Palingenesia, in which he would appear to cut a person's head and arms off. Got to think, that's quite a dramatic thing for a young boy to see, but that seemed to capture his attention. And he developed a general interest in magic, and when he was a teenager living in New York, he hooked up with some friends who also had a general interest in magic. And it was around that time that he read the biography of Robert Houdin, who was called the father of modern magic. He was really the Houdini of Houdini's day, the most famous name in magic. And that is when he decided he could make a living and a career of being a magician, and that's why he changed his name to Houdini. He added an I onto the name of Houdin and became Houdini.
And perhaps I think one of the great tragedies of that is now that there's a generation of people who don't know who Robert Houdin is and call him, I mean, I called him Robert Houdin for many years just because that was, oh yeah, he's the guy that Houdini's named after. And he's kind of, he's lost a lot of credibility. And for a while I was like, wait, which one was named after who? It wasn't until I really started to learn my magic history that I got into it. So he's really co-opted that name and made it his own.
Well, Houdini, unfortunately, has sort of co-opted all of magic history. He seems to be the only magician that anyone remembers. In the magic world, Robert Houdin is still known and respected, as are a lot of magicians of the Golden Age. But Houdini has sort of dominated, and he has become pretty much the only magician that many people know, certainly recognize, at least a magician of that time.
I know a lot of magicians who don't rate Houdini as a great magician. They say he was a great publicist. He was good at selling himself and putting together stunts that people would sort of, you know, that would turn heads, but he wasn't necessarily the best magician as a performer and as a technician. Do you think that's fair?
I think he was an incredible performer. There's absolutely no doubt about that. And there is volumes of evidence to show that he was absolutely dynamic on stage. He was a real genius with working with audience and innovating his act. It's probably true, though, that as a straight-ahead magician, he probably wasn't as impressive. It just wasn't kind of his nature. So I could see that it is true that probably when you compared Houdini doing a classic magic illusion compared to someone like Thurston, that Houdini probably wasn't as skillful or polished, or really what you wanted from Houdini. He had a different type of energy. You really wanted him to see him be the handcuff king and taking on challenges rather than doing, you know, cut and restored rope and things like that. So I think it's a little fair. I think as a magician, he probably wasn't as good a magician as some of the Golden Age conjurers. But as a magic performer, as an escape artist, there's no question that he was the most dynamic person of that entire era.
What are, you mentioned, obviously, his escapology, which is what everybody knows him for. What are some of the stunts that he is most famous for?
It evolved throughout his career. I mean, he started as he was Houdini the Handcuff King, and it was specifically about escaping from handcuffs brought by members of the audience, brought in by police departments. And he would escape from handcuffs, and he would escape from jails. And when that became widely imitated, he began to evolve it. And the idea was then, you know, anything anyone could come up with, he would escape from. So he was nailed in packing crates and you know, put in straight jackets and things like that. But he continued to evolve, and soon he started inventing his own escape apparatus, such as the milk can in which he was sealed inside of a giant milk can filled with water. And then eventually the Chinese water torture cell, in which he was hung upside down inside of a giant tank of water. And those were real masterpieces. And you've got to think about what a leap that was, because that was then raising the stakes from, you know, fail to get out of a pair of handcuffs, your reputation is destroyed. Fail at a challenge escape, you're humiliated. Now it meant failure meant a drowning death. And when he brought death into the act, that was electric. That was dynamic, and that really evolved. That was a big step in Houdini's career. The torture cell was probably the most dynamic escape that he ever developed himself. I mean, it really combined all the elements, didn't it? Hanging upside down, immersed in water. Just the apparatus itself was you know, formidable looking. It looked like a giant casket. The idea just of creating having a glass front so audiences could see you. It's a real, real masterpiece, that escape.
And part of what seems to work most about that particular escape is the idea that the audience doesn't feel like they're watching a show. They don't feel like they're watching this highly polished, rehearsed piece of theater. They're watching a man struggling with the limits of endurance and what the human body can do. They wanted the audience to believe that he was somehow more than human.
One of the ways you do that is he would insist that he wasn't. You know, he always kind of played it humbly. He would almost frequently he would say, "I don't know if I'm going to get out of this, but I assure you that I'm going to give it my best." He would always present himself that way. And it's interesting what you talk about, how he presented his acts. They were always very stark, and he always had apparatus that were very understandable. There's a tendency when Houdini movies are made to sort of dress up his water torture cell or milk can performance with lighting and dragons and mysterious, you know, a scenery. He kept it very, very stark. It was a milk can because people knew what a milk can was, even though it was a giant oversized one. It was very understandable what he was being put into. His packing crates were plain packing crates with nails that you could drive in yourself. And even his magic was like that, too. He kept it. He sometimes liked to do magic with all the stage lights turned on so that there was nothing hiding in the shadows. Part of his presentation was a very stark and realistic, and I'm not hiding anything. This is a test. You know, this isn't so much of a performance. It is a test of my ability to escape from this. He would always present it in that way.
So his career then is surrounded by death. I mean, death is every time he steps on stage, he is apparently going up against his own mortality. He is, you know, giving the audience this thrill. Am I going to survive or am I not? Do you think that his spending all of this time around death and the idea of death is really what led him to be interested later in his life and in his career in mediums and spiritualism and finding out and uncovering the truth behind that?
Well, interestingly, he became interested in spiritualism and mediums probably even before he became interested in magic, or at least around the same time. This isn't something that's generally known about, understood about Houdini. Most people will tell you that he became interested in spiritualism after his mother died. But that isn't true. He became interested in spiritualism around the same time as he started reading about magic. One of the first books he ever read on magic was Revelations of a Spirit Medium, which is a book that was written in the 1880s, I want to say. I'm not sure if I have that right. But he read that because spiritualists and mediums were doing some of the most cutting-edge magic at the time, including rope escapes and things along those lines. And so he had always had an interest in what mediums were doing, because they were doing some interesting magic. And he did have something in him that wanted to believe it was possible. His whole life, he wanted to believe it was possible. And he was always exploring different spirit mediums to see if it was possible, if this one was legitimate, and just always clearly seeing that they were fakes. And so really, from the beginning of his career, he had a side interest in mediums and spiritualism, and he read books and he collected material. And it wasn't really until 1920 that he became actively involved in debunking them. That up until that point, it was always an interest of his.
There are a lot of magicians or people involved in the magic world who have had an interest in mediumship. I mean, they've shared stages, spiritualists and magicians, but also there's that center of the Venn diagram where the skills of the spiritualist and the medium cross over with the skills of the magician. The Discovery of Witchcraft is the first magic book, but it's also the first book debunking how, you know, witches in Reginald Scott's terminology, but spiritualists work. So
right. He's
and now we have people like James Randi and Darren Brown to a lesser extent, all these magicians today doing the same thing. Houdini, though, it seems like wasn't just interested in exposing frauds. He was interested in finding out the truth.
He wanted to find out if it was possible. I think that drove him. And he would always say that, and people would say, no, he's just a skeptic. But no, he was genuinely, he wanted to find out if it was possible. And he continued, and because there were men like Sir Arthur Conan Doyle who were saying, yes, I understand there's lots of frauds and that you've encountered, but we've got some genuine mediums we want to send you to. And Houdini said, great, I want to know if this is possible. And he would come out of each seance just saying, my God, it's the same cornball tricks that I read about back in the 1890s in Revelations of a Spirit Medium. But he was always sort of searching. He seemed to have it in him that maybe it was possible.
Yeah, we talked about Sir Arthur Conan Doyle a few weeks ago on the podcast and the Cottingley Fairies hoax. So the photographs of the five photographs of either the two little girls, and how Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, while he presented himself as being, in search of the truth and rational and skeptical, was very much already on the bandwagon, already was a believer, and was really, wanted to make sure he wasn't being taken for a ride, but really just wanted to believe. Whereas sounds like Houdini was much more of a rationalist and much more of a scientific thinker.
Well, Conan Doyle was completely convinced that spiritualism was not only for real, but that it was the great religion that all people should follow. He was hardcore, and he toured and lectured on spiritualism and was kind of a sensation of that time. And when Houdini met him in 1920, they struck up a friendship very quickly, and because Houdini had spent his life also studying spiritualism, and so they were able to discuss it. And Houdini found it surprising how gullible Arthur Conan Doyle was, not just in the matters of spiritualism, but Houdini once did the thumb trick for him. What you do for little kids when you put the thumb up, and Doyle is like, "My gosh, you are a great medium!" And Houdini just found it amazing how gullible he was, what he would believe.
Of all of the mediums that Houdini went up against, perhaps the most notorious was Mina Crandon. She and him sort of danced around each other for a very long time and had a lot they sort of crossed paths on multiple occasions. Who was Mina Crandon? Who was otherwise known as Marjorie the Medium?
Well, Mina Crandon was the most famous medium of her day, ultimately the most celebrated, and she was really like no other. She was the wife of a prominent Boston surgeon. She didn't charge for her seances. Her seances were part of an evening over at the Crandons. You would have a nice dinner and conversation, and then you would go into their seance chamber, and Marjorie would have the put on these raucous seances. She was very attractive, and her seances were very sexually charged. She would be nude underneath a kimono that she would wear. She would channel her dead brother, who spoke very, you know, had very foul language and would sometimes pass sexual judgment on the different sitters. And it was good time at the Crandons. She was also just very, very, very skilled. And what happened was that Houdini had a standing challenge for any medium who could produce any phenomenon that he couldn't replicate. And the Scientific American magazine decided to also get into this game of investigating and exposing fraudulent mediums. So they formed a committee, and Houdini joined the committee. He didn't participate in every investigation, though. They kind of called him in when they needed him. But the man who ran the investigation was named J. Malcolm Bird, and he investigated Marjorie initially and completely was convinced that she was for real. He was also sort of in love with her, which was another tactic of Marjorie's, that she would seduce her her sitters. And Bird was going to give her the prize, and this would have meant the Scientific American magazine was going to validate the existence that that spirit mediums were genuine. And when Houdini found out about this, he hit the roof, and he said, absolutely not, not until I sit with her. And so Houdini and Marjorie and members of the committee, including Bird, did a series of seances. She was definitely his greatest foe.
We should explain, what were some of the phenomena that she was able to produce?
Well, you know, the most interesting phenomenon is stuff that you hear that she did in sittings outside of the Scientific American magazine. It was said that, you know, you'll hear about how mediums can levitate a table. It was said that Marjorie's table would actually leap up and at once chased a person out of the room and down the stairs. She would cause, you know, her music would play. Luminous spots would appear on her body, which you could investigate and touch. She would do some very strange things, including ectoplasm. I don't know if you know what ectoplasm is.
Oh, I've seen Ghostbusters. I know what ectoplasm is.
Yeah, well, she would produce ectoplasm from all parts of her body.
No, we need to go back to that. Let's not be coy, because this is the only reason I have you on this podcast is this ectoplasmic hand. So as best I can understand it, she would be sitting there, people would be halted, she would be searched, and then during the dim light of the seance, a small shriveled hand would creep up or appear on the table and then disappear, and people would pat her down and search her, and it wouldn't be there.
In case the listeners haven't seen Ghostbusters, I can explain just that ectoplasm was...
I don't want listeners who haven't seen Ghostbusters. No, sorry, explain ectoplasm. I apologize, go on.
It was a kind of a slimy, disgusting substance that would come out of the medium's body, maybe out of their nose, or in some cases out of, you know, out of Marjorie's vagina is where this would appear. And it would take shape. It would shape into a hand or sometimes a face during the seance, and you could touch it, or it was said that it was the ectoplasm that would be raising the table or ringing the bells. And then apparently it would disappear as quickly as it came. And there were some mediums who specialized in ectoplasm, and Marjorie did. And there's a photograph of her. You can just Google it and find it online of an ectoplasmic hand emerging from beneath her kimono, which I don't know if there's a photo of a gentleman shaking the hand or just touching the hand, but yeah, Marjorie would do that. She didn't do ectoplasm during her sittings with Houdini. The Houdini sittings, it all came down to whether or not she could ring a bell. It seems so silly to me that it all came down to if she could just ring this bell, then she must be genuine. It became more about that she didn't do the spectacular stuff with Houdini, probably because it was too easy to debunk.
There is a rumor, and I don't know if this rumor has any sort of truth to it at all, that because her husband was a doctor, that he was able to perform surgery on her in order to give her basically to make her vagina larger, or something, so that she could fit this hand in there and somehow get it out without it being noticed? Is that a true rumor, or am I insane?
You're Marjorie. That's absolutely a true rumor. That was one of the things that was said was a possibility that she was that he had done that.
But of course, being, you know, that time, it was unlikely that she was ever going to be forced to submit to a full body cavity search of that nature to find out whether that was true or not.
She would disrobe, but I don't know how aggressively anyone would search her. Well, you know what? I believe there was a female researcher who would go into a bedroom with her and search. I don't know how thoroughly she searched her, but she was searched pretty well. That's also probably why during the Houdini sessions, she was just, you know, ringing a bell box instead of producing things, because maybe she couldn't have anything on her. You know, I actually know Marjorie's great-granddaughter.
I saw her, yeah.
I've never asked her about the enlarged vagina thing. I should ask her about that.
Excuse me, did your great-grandmother have an enlarged vagina? I think that is a conversation that I would like to eavesdrop on. So obviously without, I mean, you know, it wasn't 2015, there wasn't the TSA there to do a proper search on her. So it all came down, as you said, to the ringing of a bell. There is a famous photograph of Houdini demonstrating how someone with their hands held and someone putting their feet on your feet can still ring a bell in the darkness. And I think his solution is to slip his foot out of his shoe and have a hole cut in his sock and use his toes to ring the bell. But obviously that would have been discounted. So what sort of things did he put in place so that Marjorie couldn't ring this bell, so that only the ghost could ring the bell?
Well, he brought along, you know, the idea of Marjorie was putting her under control. And that's a big thing in spiritualism, is control of the medium. And usually that just means that there's someone sitting on each side of her, holding her hands and having their feet on her feet, and that's considered control enough. But that wasn't good enough for Houdini. He actually brought along this large box that he called the Margie box, and it really just looks like a like an old-fashioned steam bath, where it encloses a whole body and just your head is sticking out through the top. And he locked her up inside of that with the bell box in front. Believe it or not, during one of those sessions in the Marjorie box, the bell box rang. And when the lights were turned on, though, it was seen that the front of the box had been forced open. And Houdini said she just forced open the box, and she leaned forward and tapped the bell box with her head. He reinforced the box. And what happened is, during one of their final seances, it was discovered that there was a folding ruler inside the box with her. Now, she accused Houdini of planting the ruler there to discredit her, should she be able to ring the bell. Of course, Houdini thought she brought the ruler in there to force it through the neck hole to ring the bell. And that seance sort of decayed into people taking sides and accusing each other of cheating. And to this day, no one really knows how that ruler got into the Margie box.
I'm sure from Crandon's point of view, that's quite satisfying, or quite a satisfactory outcome, the idea of casting doubt on the whole thing. It doesn't matter if people accuse her, because they're also accusing Houdini of being suspicious. I know in some books written many years later, it was suggested that Houdini's assistant, Jim Collins, mm-hmm. I think, actually thrown it in there, and it admitted to it in his later years that he was the one responsible, and that again just sort of cast even more doubt on the whole proceedings.
Well, the Collins quote came from a magician named Fred Keating. And Fred Keating was actually the magician that J. Malcolm Byrd had brought in instead of Houdini in the initial Marjorie sittings. And he was convinced of Marjorie, and he also disliked Houdini quite a bit. So Fred Keating is the one that said Jim Collins said that. He's not a reliable source for that. I also don't think Jim Collins would. Jim Collins never gave any secret up of Houdini's. So that quote, which sometimes is used but not attributed to Keating, I'm not, you know, I don't think that's a credible quote. So I've never really believed that. I should say that Marjorie's great granddaughter and the family in general thinks Houdini did put the ruler in the box, and I think it's possible. But the Collins quote I've never really accepted as credible.
Something that is sort of very telling is that, as you said, the whole idea that these seances were sexually charged, and that there's the nudity, the sexual suggestions, the idea of searching this woman for, you know, the luminescent spots that just happened to appear across her chest. It seems like for a lot of people, particularly, you know, perhaps in the early days, what they were getting out of the seance was nothing to do with spiritualism and more to do with being in a dark room with a beautiful woman.
I mean, she was very attractive and seductive, and it was, you know, an exciting, and it was a turn on in all ways. You know, you're with an attractive, dynamic woman, and she's semi-nude, and also, you know, you're reaching the other side, and it was all very exciting and exotic, and kind of the way the Crandons did it too. The fact that, you know, it wasn't, they weren't charging for it. It was just, you know, come over and we're going to experiment with reaching the other side and see if we can get any manifestations tonight. It was all a good time.
So if Mina wasn't interested in money, and she was clearly getting a kick out of it just for fun, why was it so important for her to go through this whole process with the Scientific American and with Houdini? Why couldn't she just ignore all of that and go and have her fun in the dark with her friends at her parties? Was she after fame, or what do you think she was trying to get out of it?
Well, that's, you know, that gets into her psychology. And a lot of this had to do with her husband. It was her husband who was the great believer in spiritualism. He was the one that, you know, ran around with all these people. And it was very important of him to prove that she had powers. It's strange. And it's sort of not unlike Sir Arthur Conan Doyle and his own wife, who was his medium. I mean, is it a way for a woman to be empowered in a marriage? When your husband is a maniac about spiritualism, you become the medium, and it gives you some power. It gives you some relevance in the marriage. I mean, maybe it's something like that, what was going on. I think maybe she did it and then got in over her head. My question is, how much did he understand she was a fraud? I think a lot of it is justified as, well, sometimes we have to fake manifestations, but she is real. She does it for real, but sometimes we have to fake it just to satisfy the people. It's a little bit of a mystery, but I think it was, she did it for her husband. And, you know, it's hard to know what it was like to be the wife of a wealthy man back then, and a smart and dynamic woman as she was, but she was very much, you know, locked in that home as a homemaker. Maybe she found it exciting. Yeah.
Just as a way to sort of get out and to see the world and meet famous people and to have some adventures.
Or more, I think it was just the way to entertain and have and feel relevant in this marriage with this dominant man she was his second wife, and he tended to get rid of his wives as they got a little older. So maybe it was also just a way to keep the marriage exciting. Or I think it was just a way that she had a good time, and I think she enjoyed it. I think she was probably horrified that she had to, you know, go before the Scientific American Committee, and she also went in front of a committee for Harvard. But, you know, she might have also gotten a thrill of how she could manipulate all these men, all these learned men. She could absolutely fool them all. That probably tickled her. I mean, I think ultimately she respected Houdini. That, and she later said he was the only one that couldn't be that she couldn't fool or seduce. By the way, that was something else that she would do.
It must have frustrated her no end that Houdini wasn't fooled or refused to accept her phenomena as real. Did she ever get angry? Did she get frustrated? Did she lash out, or did she accept it all with good humor?
She never. Well, Walter lashed out. That was her spirit guide that she channeled. That was her dead brother. And he did lash out during seances, calling Houdini, you goddamn son of a bitch, you know, get out of here, you know, or I will, something to that effect. So Walter would lash out at Houdini, but Marjorie never did. I sometimes, and again, this is speculation and gets into her character, you know, I wonder, maybe she wanted to be exposed. Maybe she wanted this all to be over. I don't know.
Because some of her techniques were fairly ballsy. Like, they were very extraordinarily not necessarily obvious, but she wasn't doing subtle things aside from the hand flying out on the table, and the levitating table was one that was quite popular, which I understand she would do by putting her head, her own head, under the table in the darkness and actually lifting up the table with her head. Or the spirit trumpet. Now, I'm remembering this from an old, I think it may have been published by Houdini himself, revealing some of her techniques. Did she put a spirit trumpet on her head at one point?
Well, yeah, that was actually part of the first seance that they had together. One of the phenomenon that she did was they had, their spirit trumpets were used in seances, and they were just kind of these metallic trumpets that would be set on the table, and they would apparently in the dark levitate, and ghosts would speak through the trumpets. And so in the dark of the first seance, Marjorie said, the trumpet is in the air. You know, where do you want the spirit to throw it? Houdini said, towards me. And all of a sudden the trumpet landed at his feet. And what Houdini realized that she had done was just in a moment that she had gotten free of her control, she had taken the trumpet and she had put it on top of her head like a dunce cap. And then regained control. And then when she asked, where do you want me to send the trumpet? And when Houdini said, do it, she just, you know, jerked her head forward and shot the trumpet towards him. So that was one of the methods that she used.
We were talking to a pair of neuroscientists a few weeks back who specialize in neuromagic, Stephen Malnick and Susanna Martinez-Condi, and they look at the neurology of why we're fooled by magic. And we're talking about those magic routines that rely on that principle where someone closes their eyes, and because their eyes are closed, they have to picture what's going on in the world around them, and they have to create a model of the world based just on touch and sound. And so if you had someone suggesting that it's floating up in the air and suggesting that this object, and then you hear it flying across the room, for a true believer, that, I mean, to us, that sounds ridiculous. She put a trumpet on her head and then threw it across the room with her neck is just stupid. But to a true believer, that must have been an extraordinarily spiritual and emotional experience.
And the power of suggestion and the setting and the dark room. You know, people see things, believe all kinds of things. You can work people into a state where they can accept far out things. What I don't understand are some of the sitters that she would with. They claim that they had lost weight during the seance because of the amount of psychic energy that she was taking from them. People participated in the deception, and it's a psychology, but that's also part of being a medium or even a mind reader or a mentalist, is that you understand the psychology of people. And that has a lot to do with being an effective mentalist or medium, is that it's called a cold reading. You understand what people are looking for, and people will give you information and they will participate quite easily.
So it's that idea. I mean, obviously cold reading is something where the psychic is taking information from the person who's being read, but it sounds like she was also seeding information and seeding ideas and giving people ownership over the seance. So letting them take a certain amount of control, and so they could go and say, oh, I've lost weight. It reminds me of Uri Geller. He wouldn't just bend a spoon on the television. He would tell people at home, put your spoon on the television and you might notice it bend a little bit. And then the amazing thing was not that he bent a spoon on TV, but just that you would have 20 or 30 people would phone into the TV station and say, you will not believe this, but the spoon bent, because they wanted to be a part of the magic. And they become endorsers of the spiritualists. And so it sounds like she really tried to get under people's skin and to get people following her and her ideas.
Yeah, well, I think she read people well. She understood people. It's funny you bring up Uri Geller and the spoon bending. You know, now mediums don't at all mess around with tambourines and trumpets and ringing bells because it's all so clearly hokum. The spoon has remained, the bending spoon, which is a magic trick. Any magician can do it. Has remained, and part of the psychology of that is that, you know, make it small enough that people can believe in it. You know, they're not going to necessarily believe in flying trumpets, but a bending spoon seems possible. He was kind of the last physical medium, the last medium that proved his powers by performing a physical feat. But of course, bending spoons, any magician can do it. But people still believe it. I did a lecture on Houdini a month before last about Houdini's spirit debunking and to a skeptical organization. And afterwards, someone came up to me and said, "That's very interesting." And he said, "Oh, but spoon bending is real." And I'm like, "Oh?" And so, yeah, I, when I was young, I said I saw someone do it. I'm like, "Okay. The spoon bending is the last the last physical manifestation that people believe of mediums."
One of the issues of debunking mediums in general is that there's really two ways you can do it, isn't there? There is what Houdini did in this case, which is to offer alternate explanations that cast doubt or cast a reasonable doubt on whether or not they have the skill or not. And then there is outright proving them to be a fraud. So being able to show that this person knowingly faked what they were doing, in the same way as the Cottingley fairies, the little girls were, it wasn't until the 1980s that they kind of admitted this is what we did and this is how we did it. And that was the moment they were properly debunked. So even though Houdini was able to explain all of these phenomena, it didn't necessarily hurt Crandon, except in that she didn't win the prize. But it didn't hurt Crandon in that believers could keep on believing and skeptics could keep on disbelieving.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. She kept her fans afterwards. And, you know, when Houdini would expose mediums on his own, sometimes he would do it very dramatically. He would go to seances in disguise, and when he knew the medium was doing their shenanigans, he would jump up and turn on a flashlight and tear off his disguise and catch them in the act, and he would have another person with him who turned out to be a police officer who would then arrest them on the spot. So he would sometimes catch mediums red-handed in that way. In the case of Marjorie, though, it was more of an investigation, and after each seance, he would explain how she did this. And then they would come up with new controls to put on her to prevent her from doing the phenomenon. And that was how they determined that she couldn't produce phenomenon with certain controls put on her, and decided to deny her the prize. But no, she had support, had her supporters in the day, including Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, of course. And probably today she still has her fans.
So how did things end up for Mina and her husband? Where did they end up after this had all died down?
Well, she continued to be very popular. There were other investigations of her. I think Harvard did a second investigation. I'm not 100% sure of her life after Houdini's death. And she made him follow, but she had a drinking problem, and she kind of, her powers and her looks faded with, as she became a little bit more of a drinker. Her husband became ill, but she stuck with her husband until the end. So she sort of petered out, continued to perform seances. That was how she made a living towards the end there, and just kind of went out with a whimper. She never really her encounter with Houdini and a year or so afterwards was really the high point of Marjorie the medium. Her name was Mina Crandon, by the way. The Scientific American Committee, to protect her identity because she was just a private person, gave her the name Marjorie. So she was only named Marjorie for the Scientific American, but she became so famous during those investigations that the name Marjorie became her name. We still call her Marjorie today, even though that was specifically created for the Scientific American investigation to protect her identity.
Right. So this wasn't a case of her taking a stage name. This was something given to her so that she wouldn't be chased down by reporters.
Outed during the course of the seances. It was, identity of, because the papers were reporting Scientific American and Houdini are investigating Marjorie. She's said to be, a prominent person in Boston society. Eventually, a newspaper outed her as Mina Crandon.
So even though, obviously, her as you said, her looks and powers faded, and she didn't get the money or the endorsement of the Scientific American or Houdini, but she did get famous. Who was the winner between Houdini and Crandon? Who came out on top? Who scored the most points, do you think, in the whole incident?
Well, you just want to say Houdini, because he didn't, had Houdini failed to expose her, or had Marjorie gotten the prize after Houdini investigated her, that certainly would have hurt Houdini's reputation. I think ultimately Houdini felt that he had exposed, the most famous medium of the day, and that was enough for him. Although she, you know, she maintained her fans, and she even, through Walter, predicted that Houdini would die within a year of a selected date. She was off, but only by about 6 months or so. Houdini did end up dying, you know, only a couple of years after their sinning. So maybe she won in that way. She had one prophecy come very close to being true.
And when Houdini died, we should, of course, just mention the code. When Houdini died, he left his wife with a code that only she would understand, and that he was going to basically send a message from beyond the grave, if it was true that there was life after death and that ghosts did exist. When he died, was that little boy who still believed in the idea that maybe ghosts did exist, was he still there, or do you think he was a full-blown skeptic and this was just one last publicity stunt?
He definitely wasn't a full-blown skeptic. I sort of wish that he was, because I feel like he never really found comfort in skepticism, that skepticism can bring some people. An example of this is in 1925, his brother Bill died. And after Bill died, Houdini shut himself inside of a room in his home and sort of sat all night in meditation and contemplation, willing Bill to come back to him if he could. So he was still sort of holding out this idea that it was possible. And I find that kind of sad. I find it kind of tragic that he would even try that at near the end of his life, when he had spent this lifetime of investigating and exposing mediums. The code that he gave to his wife, it's sometimes said that Houdini promised to come back from the dead. That isn't true. He said, if it's possible to come back from the dead, certainly I should be the man to be able to do it. But the trouble is, you know, after I die, mediums are going to come to you, he's saying to his wife, Bess, and everyone's going to claim to have heard from me. So we've got to come up with a way for you to turn the burden of proof back on them. They have to bring you this specific code that will work up between us. And so they came up with a code based on an old mind-reading act that they did in their struggling days, that a series of code words that spelled out the word believe. And that was the code that Houdini would use if it was possible to come back from the dead.
And did anyone ever break the code? Did anyone ever come with the message?
Well, one gentleman did, a gentleman by the name of Arthur Ford. In 1929, he delivered the code, and it was written up in newspapers that Houdini had come back, and Bess indeed said, this is the code that we had agreed on. Now, there's a little story behind the story, of course, and it's something that the story is told by Bessie's sister, Marie, who was really the closest person to her in her life. And according to Marie, what had happened was that after Houdini died, Bessie was pretty worried. The estate was actually insolvent when all the bills were tallied up and all the expenses were settled. And the only money she had was from life insurance. She also had a real drinking problem. And according to Houdini's brother, she ran around with all sorts of weirdos. And one of these weirdos was a gentleman by the name of Arthur Ford, who was sort of a handsome Southern spiritualist pastor. And according to her sister, they developed a romance, and he was quite a drinker too. And during one of their sessions, he said, hey, I got an idea. You give me the code. We'll do a seance, and then we will tour, and you'll never have to worry about money or companionship again. She agreed. She gave him the code. And when she realized what she had done, she later tried to kill herself. But that wasn't going to stop Ford. They went ahead. They had the seance. And the code was revealed. It all sort of decayed. There was actually Ford had worked kind of a side deal with a tabloid journalist who felt pushed out. So she sort of exposed it. It was ugly. It was a huge mess. Eventually, Bessie was able to get away from Ford and all those characters and kind of pull her life together. And in the end, she had, you know, she said Houdini had never legitimately come back to her in any way. She had been taken advantage of at certain times of her life, but she in the end was probably a bigger skeptic than even Houdini was.
So it seems like both for everyone involved, there was a sort of a sad ending for all of the parties involved.
Well, I think it's more of a happy ending for Bess, in that, you know, she went through that tough time, But she was able to pull herself together. She met a gentleman by the name of Edward Saint, who proved to be very good for her. And they moved out to California and really became part of the West Coast magic scene. And she was honored at conventions, and they had the spectacular final Houdini seance on the roof of the Hollywood Knickerbocker Hotel. And she had a good final 10 years of her life, actually. And you know, continued to speak very strongly when asked against spiritualists and spiritualism. She actually co-starred in a little or did a cameo in a movie called Religious Racketeers, which exposed mediums, and she played herself, Madame Houdini, and in the end kind of very forcefully says that she doesn't believe any of this nonsense is real.
Wow, that's fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast today. I just realized we've been talking for an hour, and we have spoken about one incident in Houdini's life that is much, much longer and much, much bigger. And there were so many other things that he was a movie star and a pilot and a raconteur and a card magician and a escapologist. And we've barely touched on any of that at all. I you will have to come back and talk more about Houdini.
I would love to anytime. It's a big subject. We could spend an hour on any one aspect of his life.
If people would like to get ahead of us and find out themselves, they should go to wildabouthoudini.com, and you can find out the truth about Houdini.
Thanks so much.
For more information on today's show, check out conman.com.au. My name's Nicholas J. Johnson, and this has been Scammapalooza.